This is Serial Killer, a true crime podcast. My name is Anne McElhenney. I'm an investigative journalist. This is the story of Kermit Gosnell, America's most prolific serial killer, who you've probably never heard of. Episode 3, Digging Deeper When No One Else Would.
We're getting information from the workers there, telling us about how he would do the procedures where the babies would be delivered alive and he would cut their necks.
We probably interviewed 3 or 4 people who testified to these snippings and killings.
You know, then we realized we had just something on our hands that was like so beyond what anybody could have imagined.
According to his employees, Dr. Gosnell was performing illegal abortions on women with almost full-term pregnancies at his clinic in West Philadelphia. Babies were being born alive and then killed. He was also killing and mutilating patients using reckless procedures or allowing untrained and unlicensed staff to administer dangerous drugs. These procedures took place amid appallingly filthy and unsanitary conditions. Oh, and he was also selling so many prescriptions for opioids that he was one of Pennsylvania's biggest drug dealers. Proving this was to be a difficult and time-consuming task. After the raid on Gosnell's clinic in February 2010, there was an enormous amount of evidence to be gathered, managed, and assessed by the investigating team. It was a multi-agency effort. Police Detective Jim Wood was working for the District Attorney's Office. Agent Jason Huff was with the FBI. And the DEA investigator was Steve Dougherty. He recalls the seamless cooperation on the case.
Woody and Jason and I worked together like 3 spokes on a wheel. As far as the teamwork, fantastic.
The investigating team also involved 2 assistant district attorneys, Joanne Pescatore and Christine Wexler. Christine told me about trying to come to terms with the scale of the case.
Woody, Detective Woods and his team, you know, they were gathering information about what had been happening on the pill mill side of things. And those witnesses wanted to cooperate. And so one by one, these workers would come in and they would sit in a conference room and they would start to tell us about what happened. And it was mind-blowing. It was hard to make sense of.
Luckily, the DA's office decided to use grand jury.
And grand jury work is different and interesting in that you're asking the questions that nobody knows the answers to. In this case, we were going to gather the facts, gather the evidence, and see what there was.
The grand jury is a particularly American institution. In Gosnell's case, it was a group of up to 70 citizens who heard evidence twice a week. Its proceedings are confidential, but in Pennsylvania, they publish a public report at the end of the process. Here is Steve Dougherty explaining how it works.
Grand jury, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, they listen to whatever evidence is there and they decide whether or not this is a even prosecutable case, whether it is legitimate to bring charges. They don't decide guilty or innocent. They decide, okay, this case is to move forward.
A grand jury was useful for this because the investigators are allowed to ask leading questions and questions about all sorts of extraneous matters that allowed them to build up a picture of just what was going on behind the doors of Gosnell's clinic. They acquired a lot of materials and leads when they raided the premises. They hoped the grand jury would help them make sense of it all. Detective Jim Wood started to establish a rapport with members of Gosnell's staff.
And it was because of the help of the other workers there that basically gave them up. You know, they were all downtrodden women, uneducated and easily taken advantage of. So if you put that into your mind of Gosnell being like a puppet master, that's what he was. He would have all these people doing his so-called dirty work. And they were tired of it. They were actually happy that we came in. And I forget who said it, but they were wondering what took so long, you know what I mean, to shut that place down.
What the staff were saying about Gosnell's abortion procedures was the most troubling. He was performing abortions well beyond the legal limit allowed under Pennsylvania law. But even more troubling, the staff said babies were being born alive. And what Gosnell did to them made the investigators believe they were dealing with a serial killer who killed often and enjoyed the killing.
He was joyful about it. What witnesses and participants described was joy. He'd deliver a large baby and say, look at the size of this guy. You need somebody to walk you to your car. You need somebody to help you with the packages. And also, he loved to eat while he was working. He would have a sandwich, he'd have soup while he's working on women gynecologically. I think the killing got his juices flowing, got his appetite rolling.
His charming persona perfectly fit the FBI's definition of a serial killer. According to the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, the BAU, quote, the majority of serial killers are not reclusive, social misfits who live alone. They are not monsters and may not appear strange. Many serial killers hide in plain sight within their communities. Serial murderers often have families and homes, are gainfully employed, and appear to be normal members of the community. Because many serial murderers can blend in so effortlessly, they are oftentimes overlooked by law enforcement and the public. Unquote.
And he was letting these workers and a child and a high school student medicate people, give them labor-inducing drugs, tend to them while they went into a precipitous labor, literally letting fetuses fall out of them while he was not even on the premises. And the more you heard this and, you know, got a sense of, you know, what was happening, you understood why the place looked like what it did. And then we started to look at the files that had been gathered to really get a sense of what was going on.
We also had a search warrant for his house where Gosnell's wife was, Pearl. Pearl was involved with doing these abortions with him as well. And the rumor was that on Sundays is when they do the most post-term abortions, so nobody else would be around to witness the size of these babies. So the house is disheveled, fleas all over the place, cats, trash, clothes, and dirty, holes in the ceilings. It was pretty disgusting.
It was like an episode of Hoarders, and we knew that he was a hoarder. I mean, we opened a freezer that looked like something that, again, you would only see on a TV episode. It was just utter squalor and so much stuff. You have to think that it says something about who he was and his state of mind. There was a pool room with this beautiful pool table. I remember thinking, this pool table is so expensive and it's so nice. But there was stuff all around it in piles that were dusty and disjointed, and it was gross. There was plants everywhere, like terrariums that were overgrown and weeds, and that made it creepy in a way. The bedroom, the stuff, the bags, the paper, it was everywhere. Maybe that helps explain some of the other things we saw.
The house was targeted for a search because the investigators knew there were a large number of medical files missing from the clinic. John Taggart is a crime scene officer and was part of the investigation team at Gosnell's house. I spoke to him over a cup of coffee in a busy shopping mall.
I've always said there's a ton of bodies somewhere. I don't know where they're at.
Could they be buried underneath the floor there or something? Is that what you were thinking? Or
I thought they were going to be in the basement, but I didn't go down. Bobby went down and Christine.
As Officer Bobby Flade and Christine prepared to search Gosnell's basement, Gosnell intervened and warned them not to venture there.
He said, oh, you don't want to go down to the basement, which of course piqued my interest even more. I mean, I was not in a position to take this man's word for where I was and where I was not going to go. We weren't going to be dissuaded by him saying, oh, you don't want to go down there, there's bugs. We thought, oh, okay, well, there's bugs, we'll go down. There are things we're looking for.
Based on their experiences in the clinic, the officers knew to expect the worst, and they also knew the search must continue. So as a precaution, the officers dressed in full body forensic suits.
And we both put on one of these paper suits with a hood, so that protected our feet, protected our hands, protected our clothing. We took with us this spray canister, you know, in what I thought was the unlikely event that there was going to be something down there. And when we got down there, it was dank and it was dirty and it was old and you really could not see much, but it wasn't you know, but minutes when we were down there. And the first thing I heard it first, was a noise on the paper suit. Like I heard like a tapping sound on the paper. It almost sounded like rain on a window pane. And when I looked up, Bob Flayed yelled something to get my attention because he could see on me. Then I quickly realized I could see on him. Was starting from his feet, was blackened, and it was creeping all the way up. It was going up his feet and up to his knees quickly. And there it was, fleas. There was a flea infestation. And we were covered in them, and they were here. They were starting from the bottom, coming all the way up the suit, and it was like a scene from a science fiction movie. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before. And the two of us started to jump around, and then we quickly got out of there. It was horrible.
With the strange sound still drumming on their suits, the officers ran out of the basement, and their colleagues helped them tear off the suits. Gosnell just looked at them and said, "I told you not to go down there." The search continued. In an already disturbing investigation, there was another grotesque discovery. Gosnell had taken intimate pictures of his patients when they were sedated.
I mean, we saw pictures, hundreds, maybe thousands of pictures that he had taken of women's genitalia.
When he was working on women gynecologically, he took a picture with his personal phone.
Speaking from prison, Gosnell defended the taking of the pictures.
It had to do with my work with infertility and with the sexual mutilization patients. I did not normally take pictures except when it applied to helping those women be comfortable with their, you're familiar with sexual mutilization, I call it clitoral surgery. And so I had photographs of those because I was working with those women about feeling normal and helping them to understand that they were capable of full sexual feeling.
It's true that there were pictures of the genitalia of women who had suffered female circumcision, but there were perhaps thousands of photos of women who had not. And as for Gosnell's claim that he was trying to make the women feel more comfortable, well, the grand jury reported that he showed the pictures to other male workers at the clinic, and even praised the skills of the surgeons who had mutilated the women. He also said he used the pictures for teaching, though there was no evidence that he taught anyone at any time anything about female genital mutilation.
He kept them on his phone. Why did he do that? Because he's Kermit Gosnell.
One of the crazy parts of that day is Gosnell playing the piano for the officers there. So eerie. He was playing Chopin while the federal agents and officers were searching his house. You know, he even asked the one officer, "Do you want me to make you breakfast?" You know what I mean? Like, you can't make this stuff up. Like I said, it's just these things that progressed throughout this case were unbelievable unless you actually saw them with your own eyes.
Gosnell did not act alone. The investigation also needed to look into the staff at the clinic. Who were they? And what was the level of their medical training and qualifications? And what did they know about what was going on at the Women's Medical Society? 10 would eventually face charges.
I would describe the group of people that worked in Gosnell's clinic as a bunch of misfits. People who needed to work to make money, but were easily manipulated to do what Gosnell told them to do.
Dr. Gosnell's nursing staff were certainly a remarkable collection. Most had troubled backgrounds. Some had mental health problems. Others had alcohol and drug use issues, with Gosnell keeping them supplied. Some staff were former patients. Some had multiple abortions. And Dr. Gosnell had his favorites among the staff, his girls, the older staff called them, with whom he had sexual relations. Of the nursing staff, only two had rudimentary qualifications in healthcare. In fact, most had a very poor standard of education, and absolutely no one had appropriate medical qualifications for the work they were doing at the clinic.
Gosnell's staff was inept, incapable, immoral. They knew what was going on was wrong. They didn't like it. In fact, the senior members of his staff graduated from the back where it was horrible and smelly and disgusting and the hours were long and he never showed up and they were left to clean up his messes. They graduated from the back to the front where they could service the pill providers and work the pill mill and make cash hand over fist working the front door. So there was a strange hierarchy. It was sad and disgusting what they did, but they were willing to do it because he incentivized them with cold hard cash and they took their paychecks and left and came back the next day. So I don't know what to think about that.
And Gosnell needed them because he knew that they would listen to him. And these workers, I believe, looked up to him in a way because he would make them think that what he was doing for the women was in their best interest. But the reality of it was, no matter how uneducated they were, they would turn a blind eye to what was really going on there.
To this day, Gosnell claims that he himself was a leading medical practitioner and was running a top-class medical facility with staff that were trained by him, and that was all they needed.
I did consider myself an expert. I still consider myself on the edge of providing care. And in designing those techniques, the people were well trained for what they needed to do. And in fact, everyone is trained to administer medication. And there was quite sufficient training. I mean, there was ongoing training both in performing ultrasounds as well as gestational sizing, as well as administering medication. They were well trained. They were just not the credentials of hospital credentials. Do you understand my point on that?
At one point, the grand jury heard evidence that there was a mother who was an employee who solicited her daughter, who was very young, to come to work, and that she allowed her daughter to inject people with Demerol, that she let her sit in this filthy environment and work late into the night, notwithstanding the fact that the high school student, her daughter, had to go to work.
Ashley Baldwin was the daughter of clinic worker Tina Baldwin. The teenager received high school credits for working at the abortion clinic. She's another example of untrained staff doing highly skilled medical work. In Ashley's case, as a teenager, she became the chief anesthesiologist for Gosnell's patients. Here is a reenactment of what she said when questioned at the grand jury about the work and her training.
Okay, so there were times when you also gave medication to patients when the doctor wasn't there?
Yes.
What kind of medications did you give?
Doc gave me a chart of medication. I couldn't really read the chart, so I made the chart over on my own and color-coded. And it was diazepam, nalbuphine, sometime Demerol, if there was no nalbuphine, and I forgot the other one.
Promethazine,
yeah.
How do you know how much to give a patient?
He gave me a book.
The doctor gave you a book?
Yes.
This was right after you turned 18 as a senior in high school?
Yes.
And did you read the book?
Yes.
What did it tell you?
It was a whole lot of percentages and decimal points and stuff. He was just like, you have to focus on this part right here. So I just read and understood the part that he told me.
Did you understand the book?
The part that he told me to read, the math, yeah, but not the words.
Okay, so did you know how to mix up or draw up the medications?
He did them first, and then he told me to do them in front of him.
How much training did you get?
Just that 20 minutes.
20 minutes. Anesthesiology is a highly specialized medical skill. The average anesthesiologist has spent 5 years in college and up to 10 years more of specialist training. Gosnell didn't care. Two women have died and countless others were mutilated and hospitalized, but he still defends using a teenager for this crucial task.
She was doing well in school. She was very bright, and I was working towards her having the goal of being a professional RN or higher because I felt she had that competence.
Gosnell also defended her mother for bringing a 15-year-old into the House of Horrors.
her position as a parent was, as long as Ashley kept her grades up and did well in school, she could work the many of hours that she wanted.
The grand jury was not impressed. They recommended Tina Baldwin was charged with racketeering, conspiracy, and they insisted the corruption of a minor.
It was the grand jurors themselves who really felt so strongly about the fact that Tina Baldwin should not be let go or needed to be held responsible for the fact that she exposed her daughter to all this. You know, they weren't going to lose sight of anything, including the fact that she had a responsibility as a parent and she was so criminally responsible or liable to what she had exposed her daughter, her own child, to.
Steve Massoff was unique in that he worked in the abortion clinic but had a background in medicine. From a well-to-do Philadelphia family, he had gone to medical school in the Caribbean but had not done a residency and had no license to practice in the United States.
Steve Massoff, I interviewed him with some of the homicide detectives, and he seemed to be an intelligent person that was, again, in my opinion, a puppet for Gosnell, someone who Gosnell saw looking for employment, supposedly a doctor. And I believe he looked at Gosnell as his mentor to show him how to do these abortions by having the baby delivered and then snipping its neck and making it look like, to Massoff, that it was a good way to do an abortion. However, I believe Massoff told us that in his heart he knew that it wasn't right, but he looked at Gosnell, being a doctor with so much time and experience, that he knew what he was talking about. But Massoff was lying to himself, knowing that it wasn't true.
Massoff testified at Gosnell's trial. His evidence was harrowing, but some said he seemed excited to be testifying. Maybe he was excited, or maybe he was finally relieved to let people know what went on in the clinic. These are actors reenacting his testimony based on actual court transcripts. He is being questioned by Gosnell's defense attorney, Jack McMahon.
Yes, he felt comfortable with it. Previously, he was doing it before I got there, and the fetuses were precipitating at the patients' homes, and that was quite disturbing, as you can imagine. So he started to bring them in. And to fit in the timeline that the procedure would take place, we added more Cytotec incrementally over time.
Okay. So over the course of your years there, and the Cytotec level increased, you started getting more and more precipitous deliveries, correct?
Correct.
Where would that take place in the clinic?
Everywhere.
When you say everywhere, where were the women having the babies there at?
In the bathrooms, in the recovery room, which was also a waiting room, a bullpen before you would go in for your procedures, in the waiting rooms on the second floor, in the clinical rooms on the second floor. We had patients also on the third floor, but on the second floor, literally it would rain fetuses. Some days I would come up, I'd be called, a scream, and I would go running, and fetuses all over the place, and blood. Literally, to draw an analogy, I felt like a fireman in hell. I couldn't put out all the fires.
With so much to investigate, Jim Wood was keen to work on the case that started it all, the death of Carnamiah Monger. Carnamiah Monger, it's an unusual name. Just who was she, and just how did this Bhutanese native end up thousands of miles away in Kermit Gosnell's House of Horrors? The grand jury investigation helped piece together her life, which had a lot of tragedy before it ended at 3801 Lancaster Avenue. Carnamiah Monger was the victim of a mostly unreported example of ethnic cleansing. At the time, Bhutan, a landlocked country in the eastern Himalayas, nestled between India and China, was known as a hippie paradise and popular with well-heeled Western tourists. As such, there was very little media coverage of the darker side of the remote kingdom. Carnamiah Monger was an ethnic Nepalese born in Bhutan. After a lot of digging, we managed to find some media coverage of Mrs. Monger's plight and the plight of her community.
In 1989, the Buddhist king issued the Diglam Nanje Edict. The But under the guise of cultural unification, the edict established a precedent for systematic racial and religious persecution aimed at forcing people to return to their supposed motherland, Nepal.
More than 100,000 Bhutanese who arrived in this refugee camp in eastern Nepal in 1991. That's when Bhutan expelled one-sixth of its population, Bhutanese of Nepalese descent, in what some people have called a campaign of ethnic cleansing.
Refugees fleeing persecution in Bhutan have arrived bearing tales of beatings, torture, and rape.
Tanamai Mangar, she lived 20 years in extraordinary poverty in Bhutan. She lived another 20 years at a refugee camp in Nepal in poverty. She gets to the United States of America, and in 4 months, she's dead at the hand in a big city, big American city, Philadelphia. She's dead at the hands of Kermit Gosnell.
She was in Virginia for a while. She got pregnant, and she wanted to terminate the pregnancy and went to him because of his later term work.
Speaking virtually no English, she arrived at Gosnell's clinic in November 2009. She received no counseling about abortion, and there was no 24-hour waiting period, even though these were legal requirements. Gosnell's staff called her the Indian woman. They didn't know she had never been to India, because they never asked. They didn't take a medical history and didn't care that she was smaller than most of their regular clients. These failures to follow basic medical practices prior to a surgical procedure were typical of the careless routines at Gosnell's clinic. In this case, it would prove fatal. She was unlucky enough to come under the care of Sherry West and Linda Williams, two employees whose carelessness and incompetence stood out even in Gosnell's already shambolic and chaotic clinic.
So Linda Williams and Sherry West, they were known as the Delaware girls, and they were very close. They were rough, unkempt, and I'm trying to think of the right words, but not your typical receptionists or caregivers, and not someone who should be catering to patients. Sherry West was more aggressive with the women. And again, she had hepatitis C and may have had other transmittable diseases, and she should never have been working with those women.
It's probably needless to say at this point, but the Delaware girls did not have the required medical qualifications to treat patients or administer drugs. We do know Williams had an eighth grade education.
I remember interviewing Linda several times, and in the beginning, I think even though she didn't want to be totally honest with us, eventually I think she felt more comfortable. And it's like that whenever we interview people. The first time it's kind of hard to get information from them, but after you talk to them for several times, it flows easier and you get more and more from them.
According to the grand jury report, Sherry West and Linda Williams provided several contradictory and unreliable accounts of what took place at the clinic that evening. But what is clear is that Mrs. Mangar was doomed from almost the moment she stepped into the clinic. I am haunted by the facts of Mrs. Mangar's death. She couldn't speak English. She had lived a life of poverty, but nothing in her life prepared her for the horror of Gosnell's Women's Medical Society. As she lay in the squalor of the clinic, being administered drugs by the two untrained, uncaring women, she must have realized they were killing her. They testified that she, quote, put up a fuss, end quote. It's always struck me, that phrase. Mrs. Mangar realized what was happening and wanted to escape, but she couldn't find the words to cry out for help.
Karnamai Mangar died of an overdose, and it wasn't accidental. But we had to understand what happened to her first. And what we learned very quickly, again, in developing these relationships with these witnesses was these women who were administering gross amounts of Demerol and promethazine and, you know, just single-handedly acting as anesthesiologists, absent any way to monitor what they were doing, you know, using a color-coded chart, you know, were in no way prepared to handle what was happening there day in and day out. And it was a matter of time before something as tragic as what happened to her.
The anesthesia there was decided on how much you wanted to pay. Now, they gave a menu, a laminated menu of four prices, from Twilight to something else. And you would pay however much you could afford. That's how much anesthesia you got.
According to the grand jury report, Linda Williams and Sherry West, under the phone direction of Kermit Gosnell, just kept pumping Mrs. Monger full of dangerous drugs. This is part of the report read verbatim by an actor.
Williams acknowledged that after she took Mrs. Monger to the procedure room, she gave the patient more sedating medication, this time the clinic's, quote, custom, unquote, dose. The custom dose, as described on the clinic's anesthesia chart, consists of 75 milligrams of Demerol, 12.5 milligrams of promethazine, and 10 milligrams of diazepam. West told the FBI that before Williams anesthetized Mrs. Monger in the procedure room, she and Williams telephoned Gosnell, who had not yet arrived at the clinic. According to Williams' statement, Gosnell instructed her to, quote, med her up, unquote.
And apparently she was waking up from her anesthesia, and he used the words med her up, meaning give her more Demerol. So Linda Williams basically eyes up. And that's what Latasha Lewis said. Like, that's how she would measure the amount of anesthesia and Demerol she'd give her. Just look at it, eye it up, and then put it in the IV.
Following the doctor's orders, Linda Williams administered a second custom dose. Dr. Andrew Herlick, the chairman of the anesthesia department at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, told the grand jury that at that stage, Mrs. Monger's death was inevitable. This reenactment is the grand jury summation of Dr. Herlick's evidence.
Dr. Herlick was incredulous when asked, hypothetically, about the effects of two custom doses. The anesthesiologist could not conceive why a doctor would ever give two doses. Dr. Herlick opined that if average-sized adults with no particular sensitivities to the drugs were given two custom doses within 4 hours, most would stop breathing. Mrs. Monger was 4 feet 11 inches and 110 pounds, significantly smaller than average, and she did, in fact, stop breathing.
She comes from this country to what we think of as the United States of America, and she receives care that's so below standard, so subpar. It was so beyond negligent. It was criminal, notwithstanding the fact that she can't communicate with you. She can't tell you what she's feeling. She is very short in stature. Her ethnicity very obviously would impact any way that she would metabolize a drug that's been given to her. And there was no consideration given about that by anybody.
When he eventually arrived at the clinic, Gosnell started Mrs. Monger's abortion. Then Linda Williams alerted Dr. Gosnell to Mrs. Monger's worrying change in color. She then went into cardiac arrest. Another of the untrained and unqualified staff, Elizabeth Hampton, remembers the panic in the building that night.
Well, actually, the girls were running out from the back, Ashley, Linda, and they were running like around. I'm like, well, what's going on? And they were looking for the key. So I'm like, well, what's going on? And they said they had to call the ambulance. For Mrs.
Monger.
And I went in the back. I want to know what's going on. So I went to the back, and she was lying on the table. And he was just standing there looking, and he said, can you go up and get their family, her family?
And then the circumstances of what unfolds are just horrific. I mean, she is lifeless. There was no attempt to resuscitate her. There was not a way to get 911 in the door. The padlocks weren't, you know, they couldn't get a stretcher into the location because of how twisted and tight and triangular the facility itself was.
Lieutenant Don Burgess of the Philadelphia Fire Department testified that when he arrived, Gosnell had appeared confused and discombobulated. Burgess said he was astonished when he eventually found the procedure room with Mrs. Monger inside. No one was performing CPR on the dying woman.
This building had a lot of doors, and some of the doors were locked and they lost some of the keys. They couldn't get her out. They had to try to break one of the locks to get her out of there.
A routine inspection of the building would have identified any such problems. And locked emergency exits in a medical facility would have meant an automatic closure of the premises. But remember, no one from the state or city authorities had been near the clinic in years. The ambulance carrying Mrs. Monger arrived at the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania shortly after midnight. She was in a critical condition, but Mrs. Monger was to suffer more ill treatment at the hands of Gosnell's staff. This is a reenactment of the grand jury report about Mrs. Monger's death.
Wes grabbed the chart and took it herself to the hospital. By the time the file was turned into hospital doctors, it had notations about medications that Ashley Baldwin said had not previously been there. The notations were totally inconsistent and grossly understated the amount of medication that was given.
And staff told even more lies. They said Mrs. Monger became ill while she was watching TV in the recovery room after her abortion. And they claimed Mrs. Monger had taken drugs in an attempt to abort the baby herself before she arrived at Gosnell's clinic. These were all lies. At the hospital, doctors fought to save Mrs. Monger's life, working with scant and inaccurate information about what had happened to her. She died at 6:15 p.m. on the 20th of November, 2009.
But after surviving 40 years of poverty in the third world countries, she gets to the city of Philadelphia and she's dead in a doctor's office. So that was pretty upsetting.
The only reason the world has heard about Carnamaya Monger is because of a very good cop, Detective Jim Wood. He did what no one at the Department of Health in Pennsylvania or the Department of State bothered to do. He did the job all these public servants were paid well to do, but didn't.
Woody is the best of everything. Woody is smart, compassionate, fierce, dogged, and always about doing the right thing. So the fact that Woody, on his own accord, learned that a woman named Carnamaya Monger had died in the facility when he was otherwise looking at, you know, a pill mill type case, and he asked the right questions for the right reasons, and that he cared enough about a woman that nobody cared enough about.
Detective Jim Wood was the first person to question Gosnell about what happened to Mrs. Monger. Gosnell was blasé about the case of a woman who died in his care.
So then I started asking him about this, the death of Carnamaya Monger. He just kind of like, matter of fact, I can explain things away. And I said, okay, Doc, Linda Williams gave her medication, and he denied that she did that. He said, no, I was there. Or if he did instruct her to do it, that he was on location, but he wasn't. And, you know, he acted nonchalant about that. Like, no, I was there. She, you know, she was unconscious and we did everything. Just downplayed the whole part of her death.
Speaking from prison, Gosnell maintains that nonchalance and even tries to blame Mrs. Monger.
So, no, I did not administer the medication myself, but I have given that dosage, oh goodness, I say 30,000 times, 40,000 times, because I use that same dosage over a shorter period without any problem. And I'm convinced that Carnamaya Monger, took pain medication herself to prevent the possibility of pain. And I think that that contributed greatly to her reaction to a medicine that I'd given over 30,000 times without problems.
This is a good example of Gosnell's style. He lies all the time. It's so easy for him. Mrs. Monger did not take any pain medication. Toxicology tests proved that. But worse is Gosnell's suggestion that there was nothing wrong with unqualified, barely literate workers administering anesthesia. He knows perfectly well that this is not only unacceptable, it's criminal. And the locked doors in the clinic that delayed the treatment of a critically ill patient? Again, he is dismissive.
almost a comedy of errors. We couldn't find the key because, in retrospect, whoever had locked it the last time had placed it in their pocket. We'd had that problem before. And we eventually did get the access to the building with bolt cutters.
Gosnell's dismissal of the locked doors is just another lie. The crucial time lost when the emergency doors couldn't be opened contributed to Mrs. Monger's death. Gosnell didn't care. On the night Mrs. Monger fought for her life at the hospital, Kermit Gosnell continued back at the clinic as if nothing had happened. He finished the remaining abortion procedures and then wrote dozens of illegal prescriptions for drug dealers. That was the business side of things. Then, starting at 2.09 a.m., the then 68-year-old doctor made 12 late-night phone calls to Jennifer Leach, his then 28-year-old mistress. He also phoned her six times the following day. Leach told investigators he didn't tell her the shocking news about the dramatic rush to hospital and subsequent coma of one of his patients. An illicit affair is not a criminal matter, but it is important to note that Jennifer Leach was a patient of Dr. Gosnell's since she was 17, and the American Medical Association deems doctor-patient sexual relationships unethical. Gosnell was paying Leach $300 weekly for psychosocial counselling, despite the fact that she had no training as a counsellor. She often didn't even show up at the clinic on the single day a week she was supposed to. Gosnell's only response to the death of Mrs. Monger was to attempt to clean up and paint his filthy premises. Liz Hampton remembers the aftermath. After Mrs. Monger died, we cleaned up real good, she said. Gosnell clearly expected inspectors from the State Department of Health to come calling, but he needn't have worried. Nobody in the city or state government cared. If the authorities had regularly inspected Gosnell's clinic, the issue of access for emergency services would have been found and corrected. The untrained staff would have been exposed. The poor medical routines and faulty monitoring machines would have been noticed. The illegal abortions would have stopped. And Mrs. Monger would probably be alive. The grand jury wanted to know why the Department of Health had not fulfilled its duty.
So the chief counsel for the Department of Health was called before the grand jury, and her response was that it wasn't a suspicious death, notwithstanding the fact that a perfectly healthy woman walked in and then died for no discernible reason at that point in time. Her response was simply just a cold and cavalier, well, people die. And it was a callous remark, and the grand jury was shocked and appalled by the nature of how cold that response was from the chief counsel to an agency that was failing in their obligations to inspect the clinic.
There is a sad addendum to the Carnamaya Monger story. Detective Jim Wood recalls Gosnell's behavior during the search and believes it showed he wanted to remember killing Carnamaya Monger.
In the far right lower section of that freezer, there was a baby wrapped in a paper towel in a clear bag. And Gosnell says, oh, by the way, that's Carnamaya Monger's baby. Because all the others were in biohazard bags and in milk jugs, and you couldn't see anything. But this baby, you could see. And he pointed out that her initials were on the bag, KM, Carnamaya Monger. And you could see the shape of the baby. You could actually see the baby. And that was, I guess, one of those things that some of the officers didn't want to see. And it was just sitting there wrapped in a paper towel. Serial killers collect trophies. And in my mind, he kept that as like his trophy. Because remember, Carnamaya Monger died in November of 2009. That baby was still in the freezer February 19th, 2010, several months later.
Of course, the grand jury was doing more than investigating the death of Carnamaya Monger. Gosnell was also being investigated as a serial killer. He was potentially responsible for the deaths of hundreds, perhaps thousands of babies, allegedly born alive and then killed at his clinic. Next time, we're going to look at the growing evidence that Gosnell was a serial killer. In the next episode, what happened to the babies? Serial Killer, a true crime podcast, is a production of the Unreported Story Society. To learn more about the investigation into Dr. Kermit Gosnell, you could read my book, Gosnell, The Untold Story of America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. It's co-written with Phelan McAleer. I'm Anne McElhenney. This podcast was produced by Phelan McAleer. Magda Segeda was executive producer, and it was edited by Peter Kelly. To get the next episode of Serial Killer, please subscribe for free on your podcast app and sign up for our email list at serialkillerpod.com.